AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Today's episode of The Beat is brought to you by the Waterworks and Header HVAC, now better to serve you together and proud sponsors of Ohio State Athletics. Sometimes 6 days is all it takes for a complete change in perspective. Welcome to a Freaky Friday mailbag on the Austin and Berm Show presented by the Waterworks. Yes, it was a week ago, less than a week ago, I guess, that Ohio State lost a game. But I think we could all agree it's time to move on from that because it could be a lot worse. Ohio State is the number two seed. They're going to the Cotton Bowl. They have a Heisman Trophy finalist, and they don't have a cheating scandal on and off the field like their rivals do. So things could always be much, 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 much worse than what Ohio State has, Berm.
That's correct. It could always be worse. I mean, obviously, this is a difficult situation for Sharon Moore and his family, and you certainly want people to not have to be dealing with these sort of fallout. But as far as the football side of it goes, Ohio State is obviously in a pretty good position culturally and from a program standpoint. And that's what Ryan Day talked about on the Thursday morning episode of The Beat with me as we broke down the recruiting stuff. Like the one thing Ohio State's able to sell right now more than anything to anybody in the country is that there is stability and decency at Ohio State. And it's not necessarily all the, that's not the case everywhere else. And as a fan of Ohio State football, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are gleeful that Michigan is once again reeling, but hey, that's what happens. Been a rough few years up there.
Well, you know what? But that's what happens is brushing it off. Like this has been going on now for like a decade at Michigan. And you have covered, and we talk about this all the time in the build up to the game. You have been around Ohio State and the game your whole life. The 14 years that I have been around this rivalry, and people will say it's because of the team that I cover, I've been disgusted by what they do on the other half of the rivalry, like by what they do on the field, the way that they carry themselves off the field, to have these things piling up the way that they have the last 5 years. And we talked about just like the post-game shenanigans going on in the tunnel this year and Sharon Moore handling all that. You could remove all the rest, and that's as horrifying as it gets. And I hope that everybody gets, Sharon Moore's family and the person involved in this that was threatened, according to all the court reports and the police reports and all that. Like I hope that everybody is okay. I wish nothing but the best for them. I'm even removing that from this conversation. What this program up there needs a complete restart, because when you're talking about multiple coordinators being involved in legal matters, when you're talking about an NCAA infractions case, when you're talking about the cheating scandal with Connor Stallions and the spying scandal, like this stuff has been happening year over year over year. And we got a bunch of questions about it. I didn't want to narrow it down and just pick one before we get into actual Ohio State matters on this mailbag day, Freaky Friday mailbag. But I mean, we have to like dive into some of that because this has been a long time coming for the Wolverines.
Yeah, and as we saw with the Connor Stallions fallout, guys like Chris Partridge and people like that who were terminated before it all really even got to the NCAA, what you're going to have here is fallout that is unexpected. If there's a bunch of people that have known about this for months, they're going to be held accountable for it. And that starts obviously at the top with Ward Manuel. I think the interesting thing for Michigan is how do you hire a head coach in these next couple of weeks, knowing that you have an interim president. There is very likely going to be a change in their athletic head with Ward Manuel. I don't see how he survives this after the comedy of errors that they've undergone in the last handful of years. And then you have no head football coach. It is going to be a very interesting time. I think that there are a lot of people who will look at the Michigan job, and I'm one of them sometimes, and say, well, hey, it's one of the four or five best jobs in sports. People will be lining up to take it. But when you start to look at the totality of what's going on up there and all of the pieces that may not be in place, it certainly lends credence to me. And I mentioned this on the radio with you and Brandon Beam on Wednesday night, but When Sherrone got promoted, there was a lot of people, and even people who I know that are close to the Michigan program, who said, "You know, I don't know why Michigan didn't do a lengthy search, why they weren't really going after a big name at that time." And there was a mindset that Sherrone was always kind of the fall guy and going to be a stopgap here, which I'm not trying to support his claims or what Adam Schefter said, that maybe Sherrone felt like people were against him. But I'm not going to say people were against him. I think people knew from the start that he was going to be there until they were cleared with the NCAA, and then they were going to move on because he was never qualified to be the head coach at the University of Michigan. So now you have to figure out which guys are going to want that opportunity with all of this other chaos happening. But as I said on the Letterman Row message board on Friday, sometimes chaos brings opportunity and leverage. And so if you're a coach like Kalen DeBoer at Alabama, that maybe feels unappreciated and or on the chopping block there because you are the guy to follow Nick Saban, maybe that situation feels more stable. Who knows? So there's going to be a lot of moving parts. I saw Pete Thamel on Thursday afternoon say that he thinks that this won't be a quick decision. I've seen other people, John Bacon, who obviously is a Michigan historian and very connected, saying that he thinks they'll have a coach within 5 to 10 days. 10 days would line up pretty much directly with the end of Alabama's first game in the playoffs. So that is interesting and worth noting, especially if this investigation has been ongoing since November. But I mean, there are reports that Michigan actually asked Sherrone more about this in the summertime. So the fact that he lied to them and it's been covered up and it's been basically, let's call a spade a spade here, Austin. If Ohio State had lost to Michigan on November 29th, would Sherrone Moore have been fired on Wednesday? Probably not.
I highly doubt it.
Yeah, probably not. They'd be in the playoff. They wouldn't be firing him. So, you know, it feels Jeremy Pruitt-esque at Tennessee, but
I mean, they could have Berm. That's the other part. Like why I'm talking about not just Moore specifically, I'm talking about Michigan as a whole, and I'm going to include the university and the athletic department. If that investigation had been going on that long and they got through signing day, they let like Kerry Combs, man, the collateral damage for him, someone that I've known for 14 years. I mean, he took a pretty big risk going to the other side of the rivalry and everything against what he's known and fought against his whole life. Like what is he dealing with in the fall? Like the collateral damage here is nuts. And Michigan chose to do this on the date that they did after the high school recruits had signed their deals, whether with the school or national letters of intent, coaches coming in, making these hires. Like it is unthinkable that they've handled it this way to me.
It is, because again, you certainly understand that things are different now. It's not the same world where if you let go of a coach after signing day, that player stuck, but you still do murky the waters quite a bit for these players and the families, because A, NIL money is dispersed now. So it's not like you can just say, hey, what Michigan was offering me, someone else has to give me the same amount. Rosters are filled up. There are things that make it a lot harder for a kid to leave that situation right now than it would have 2 weeks ago or a week ago. And so we're going to see how those players respond. Obviously, players on the Michigan roster are going to have an opportunity to leave. And that does put Michigan at a little bit of a disadvantage when it comes to trying to make a quick decision here. Because the longer this goes, even though the players, like those players can leave January 2nd without a head coach. So they're going to have to, it's not the same. In a normal situation, you have 5 days after the coach is hired. But with the actual portal window coming in 3 weeks, if they don't have a decision there, they risk losing a lot.
I mean, potentially their entire roster, and deservedly so. That's the bill that they should have to pay for what they did. In my personal opinion,
it's similar, and I don't mean to cut you off, but when we go back to the Connor Stallion stuff, and there was this mindset when the NCAA punishment came down that, hey, why should you punish the players? Why? Like, they knew too. They knew what was going on. And I'm not going to stand here and try to be all pious and say, well, Sherrone Moore should be terminated for it because he was having an extramarital affair. I'm sure that there's clauses in his contract that suggest morality clauses. But that's irrelevant. The point is, he obviously lied to their administration about it when they confronted him about it the first time. And so ultimately, that's probably why he's being terminated, or why he's been terminated. And the fact that it seems like the alleged victim here in the Wednesday night potential assault or whatever is the reason, like the 911 call saying that she felt like he'd been stalking her for months, to me indicates that he probably was told months ago by her, this has to end, and didn't. which obviously turns it into a criminal matter and not just a moral issue for the Wolverines to have to sort out. So once it goes criminal, I think the timing of this is indicative of that. The report, the 911 call came in on Wednesday afternoon around 4 o'clock. He was fired at what, 4:45, right? So it was the call, I think, that actually led to the termination, not the investigation.
Yeah. And he was already working under a show cause because, by the way, this program had been cheating and breaking rules for years. This question did come in from A-Dub in Columbus. Who is the coach?
Wait, you're A-Dub.
Oh, that's me. Who you speak, I think, for a lot of the fans and a lot of our audience. Who would you say would be the coach that you would fear the most going into Ann Arbor?
I guess it's Kalen DeBoer, which I guess makes sense why he's their first choice and clearly their first choice. But I don't know why that's so scary, honestly. Like, he obviously did a pretty good job at Washington. He's done a fine job at Alabama, but it has not elevated Alabama, which, of course, nobody expected him to. But it has downgraded a little bit in his time there. I'm interested in the idea that Lincoln Riley would be a fun choice up there, because I think that'd be an interesting couple of years. Between him and Ryan Day and Michigan, obviously.
What part of it is fun?
I don't know. Michigan hasn't had an offense in years. And I think if you like try to compare the programs, it's always sort of been the yin versus the yang, the dark versus the light, the opposite sides of the coin, how they were building their programs. And Lincoln, I think, would be the first one that they've had probably since Rich Rodriguez, who would come in and try to do things his way and not the quote unquote Michigan way. So that would be interesting. DeBoer is the one, because I think he's got the most well-rounded approach to building a program of the names that are out there. Unless there's, you know, there are under the radar names and guys that are not quite as famous that Michigan media members have already brought up, coaches out on the West Coast and stuff like that. But I don't know that anyone should be afraid of it. But it's just different, because in this era of college football, the idea that a roster gets blown up in 3 weeks, like, that's scary, but at the same time, you can build a roster in 3 weeks. So, you know, as long as you have the money to do so. Now, that is, of course, Michigan's other problem, and that they owe how many millions of dollars in fines to the NCAA. And so a lot of the donors who may have been excited about a coaching change, the donors that might have seen this as like a dead cat bounce, maybe they're waiting to see who the hire is before they get behind it and start donating again. So there's all these side conversations that now become really, really relevant. And I don't think anybody knows what's going to happen from here, because, like I said, there's likely to be more firings.
Yeah, you would assume so. All right, now it is time to actually get into the mailbag. Thanks for your patience. And thanks to everyone who wrote in at theaustinandbermshow@gmail.com. I would bet a lot of money that we'll probably have another one of these before we get to the Christmas holiday, maybe around Christmas. But I want to remind you to keep your home winter ready ahead of Christmas with the Waterworks and Header Energy Savings Plan. Get priority heating service, members-only savings, and continuous comfort all year long. Call today to schedule the Waterworks and Header, 614-232-2222. Ryan kicks us off, and here's what I mean about some change in perspective. Ryan says that he is not nearly as bummed about the loss to Indiana as most of the fan base seems to be. With everything that happened last week, Heartline interviewing, signing day chaos, and he didn't write this, but Berm, you've mentioned as well, and we both have the Matt Patricia situation. There was so much going on there for Ryan Day and everybody else. It's hard to believe the offensive staff wasn't at least somewhat distracted. I would say they were. Add in Cignetti hinting that Indiana basically had 3 weeks to prep for Ohio State because of their schedule, bye week, and then Purdue. It feels like we were playing from behind before the game even started. All that said, we had a chance to win the game and a month to plan before the CFP. Am I off base in looking at the game this way?
No, but rational thought is not always encouraged. Rational thought is not always celebrated.
No, I think it's always encouraged.
It's always encouraged, but it's not really adhered to and or given much credence when it comes to fanaticism and fandom of Ohio State football. This is the right approach. Again, I don't want to feel hypocritical, because after that game, you know, we were obviously pretty confused at the way that Ohio State looked, the way that they seemed like they prepared. But prior to that, the entire week leading up to it, and actually for months leading up to it, you and I were talking about which game could they afford to lose? Which game, if you had to pick one, what is this game going to matter? And other than, and I know other than is a giant asterisk, and I know people will be annoyed by it, other than getting a silver football in the Woody Hayes Athletic Center and getting a banner, what did last week's game matter? And so to now, if you let it matter to you from a perspective of, holy crap, Ohio State looked this way, this is how they looked at last year's game against Michigan, and now I feel substantial worry that they can't get it righted, that's a different conversation. But in a vacuum, that game means nothing. So what you take out of it, what you gain out of it is the real important thing here. And I do think that there's a lot to be said about Indiana having essentially a 3-week prep time leading into that game, because that is a major, major advantage. And you can't overlook it. And when you have a coaching staff that's as good as what the Hoosiers have put together, they're going to find ways to exploit some things and take advantage of some things. And they did it. So do I think Ohio State is unfixable? Do I think they're broken heading into their first round game against Miami or Texas A&M? Absolutely not. Do I think that there's changes that have to happen? Of course. I think some of that is just going to happen naturally. We've started hearing rumors on Thursday about a potential procedure that Tegra Shibola needed done. We don't know if that's going to cost him the rest of his season, but people I talked to said it's very likely he won't play in that first game. So we'll see what happens. But some of those changes are just going to happen by default. Others are going to require the Ohio State coaching staff to get a little more intensive when they return to campus and everyone gets back to work on Sunday.
Yeah. So here's the part where I want to make every attempt to not be hypocritical. Ohio State, the players on the field were trying to win. The coaching staff tried to put together a plan. I think that between the two, I don't really fault. Yes, the execution could have been better for Ohio State. I think that that was another example of poor game planning, poor in-game play calling, and maybe lackluster in-game adjustments were too late, especially when it comes to Tegra Shibola. If he was banged up or not, he was clearly ineffective throughout that first half, and it took too long to go to Gabe Van Sickle and another option, and the offense responded when he went out there. So I'm putting that on the distractions. I think Ohio State tried to win, and that all being true, that no one was going through the motions on the field, that even if in hindsight the coaching staff recognizes that they were stretched too thin and they didn't do the best job, the things that they came up short with, they will have to look in the mirror. They will have to self-scout. And I know that that is happening already. It was happening on Sunday when we were in the Woody. I've talked to a half dozen people already about the things that each of them have taken ownership of and the way that that's going to get corrected. And so, yes, there are things from Saturday night that I'm not saying to brush that under the rug. Ryan's feeling optimistic. I think both of us feel like Ohio State is unlikely to go into a game against Texas A&M and Miami unprepared and unable to win it. I still think Ohio State will win the national championship. They're the betting favorite for a very good reason. But some of the things that have lingered, whether that is, you know, rotation or lack of rotation or lack of success on the right side of the offensive line, whether that is what we've seen with red zone deficiencies, whether there are other things that maybe need to be done to be more aggressive. And I don't blame the defense for the loss on Saturday night. They gave up 13 points to Indiana and a Heisman Trophy finalist. If there's things that they can do to put Arvell Reese and Caleb Downs, which we will get into that later on in this mailbag, there's obviously ways that Ohio State can improve, and I think that they will. So there's no reason to be down and out about this team, but everybody, I think, collectively can see the parts that have to be enhanced to win three games. And that's, I think, the fact that Ohio State actually wanted to win a silver football and was putting forth an effort to do so means that it won't dismiss the things that didn't work against Indiana.
Yeah. And again, to quote Ryan Day from a few weeks ago, you're like, he saw what we saw. It's not a guy that is out of touch with his football program or clueless about the things that are going wrong. How they address it, we'll see. But I don't have any lingering doubt that this coaching staff is going to struggle to find a game plan that works in the future. So I definitely don't think that.
Yeah, agreed. And Andrew followed up on what I alluded to there with Arvell Reese and Caleb Downs. He had, you know, some more ammunition and stats to back this up, but he was talking about the two generational talents on defense, but he feels that they are hardly put in positions to make plays. Ohio State stopped using Arvell as a pass rusher in one tackle on Saturday against Indiana. Caleb Downs is great and a consistent tackler, but not the ball-hawking safety that it seemed like he was at Alabama. Ohio State plays conservative, and the best players are not making a game-changing impact. Can the Buckeyes get more out of these guys, or is that just the defensive scheme? I understand as well it is a historical defense and not the reason the Buckeyes lost to Indiana.
Correct. They gave up 13 points. Obviously, it was a game where Indiana had a really good game plan and some really good players and making some big plays. But Ohio State, I think back to the 22 defense, Jim Knowles' first year, a team that ultimately had a lot of players who got drafted, a lot of very good players on that team. They were talented, but super aggressive and not able to hold up when the pressure came in big moments because they were just getting gashed on huge plays. Indiana did a great job exploiting a couple matchups, especially in the slot against Lorenzo Styles, taking some shots down the field, beating Jermaine Matthews on some go balls. But ultimately, this defense has been predicated on the fact that you have those players. And those players mean that you can play a very base defense. I don't want to call it basic D because obviously that harkens things back to 2016 and that team that was very upset about being called a basic defense. But that's what this defense is from a structural standpoint. It's we have better players than you, and we don't need to let these guys take crazy chances. What we need is for these guys to not give up huge plays. And because eventually the totality of the defense, the weight of the defense, the boa constrictor nature of the defense up front, the fact that Kenyatta Jackson, Caden Curry, Caden McDonald are all playing better and better and better as the year gets along. Sonny Styles playing the way he is. Like, I completely agree. I mentioned it on a show the other day. I think that there has been a lack of pass rush opportunities for Arvell Reese in the last few weeks that I don't entirely understand. But the thing about Caleb Downs, and we've talked about it this year and last year, his statistical output is never going to really spotlight what his role is or what his impact is on this defense. He is the last line of defense, and nobody ever gets behind him. So as Ohio State has continued to put him in positions to do multiple things, like he's almost this combination of Jordan Fuller and Malik Hooker at one time, but like we haven't seen him being asked to do the Malik Hooker things. When he does get asked to do that, we've seen what he can do. So it is frustrating at times because you see all these parts and you think maybe we need to get more exotic. Maybe we should try take more chances, take more risks. But the reason you've given up the fewest points in college football and have the number one ranked defense in the sport is because your defense is playing structurally sound. They're playing not conservative, but they are playing smart, and they're not allowing themselves to be dictated to, which is something that I have often believed the Ohio State allows on the offensive side of the ball. And I've talked about it for years. I think the Buckeyes offense sometimes lets their opponent's defense dictate what they do instead of doing what they do best. And Matt Patricia has not fallen into that trap on defense, which I think is smart.
Yeah. And I think that there would be a temptation if you were in that defensive coordinator role that you have athletes with the ability of Arvell Reese or Caleb Downs or Sonny Styles and be like, well, I'm just going to send these missiles at the quarterback and, you know, whatever. We'll live with the consequences if they don't get home. Like I can understand that. Let's get them some stats. Let's do this over here. Let's just create the most exotic scheme imaginable and see how they do. Like Ohio State's defense now with Matt Patricia is at a point where opponents have to know where 8 is on every single play. They have to know where 2 is on every single play. And that, you know, last week led to a ton of opportunities for Sonny Styles. Like, you have 9 tackles at halftime. Like, he was everywhere making a huge impact for Ohio State. So, you know, I can see the perspective of Andrew. I don't disagree with it. And I'm sitting here of two minds with it. I trust what Matt Patricia is doing with the scheme. And when the time comes that you have to have a play from Caleb Downs and Arvell Reese, I bet that they'll get it. I just don't think that it's like designing something specifically to get the football into Jeremiah Smith's hands. Sometimes, a lot of times that's going to work, but sometimes it can be a detriment if you're not just taking what a defense gives you. It's almost the same way if Ohio State is playing offensive defense, well, defend what's in front of you. I think they're doing a better job of that. Obviously they are than anyone else in the country. They are still the number one defense statistically across the country. The individual stats aren't there. I get that. You look at what Arvell Reese can do and you'd think that you'd see more flashy numbers across the board. I don't think that means that his impact is actually diminished personally.
No, because if you let him do that, then you're taking something else off the field. And that's what you have to be willing to compromise. In some ways, it feels like the 2015 offense almost, like where it's like, if you design a play and it has to go to Braxton on this play, or you have to throw to Mike Thomas on this play, then all of a sudden, if that is covered, if that's taken away from you, then the play looks disjointed.
I think what you're looking for is the 2016 all Curtis Samuel all the time offense.
I liked that a lot better than I liked the 2015 offense that didn't know what the hell they were supposed to do, because they were like, well, we have to get Braxton 4 touches. We have to get Zeke 20 touches. We have to, like, if you just say this is what works for the defense, those players are going to make plays in natural order and as the game calls for it. So I think that I understand Andrew's point here, because again, I feel similarly about Arvell Reese. I mentioned it to Mick Walker of Led Monroe on the field on Saturday night. I said, I really feel like they need to be giving Arvell a little bit more opportunity to impact the game splash plays wise, but it's worked all year long and it didn't not work on Saturday. They gave up 13 points to the number two ranked offense in the country. So I think that it's tweaking, it's finding the right moments to deploy those things. Because yes, you can get more out of those guys, but if the more you get out of them, the more you ask of them, how many more opportunities are there going to be for the offense to exploit holes somewhere else? Because that's what these guys are. They're hole fillers, but they're making it so the defense is like 13 players. That's what Arvell and Caleb do.
Yeah, and I will be a broken record. We wouldn't be having any of these conversations if they had called one hold, or maybe even two, because Ohio State, their scheme was working, and Indiana was, as you said, like, you're playing against 13. Indiana was allowed to play with 16 players because they had five officials helping them out as well. But that sounds like spoiled grapes, and I'm not going to whine about that anymore. It was just bad officiating, and at some point I'll get over it, probably the next time Ohio State plays a game. Greg wrote in, said, do you think that the chances for Julian Sayin to win the Heisman Trophy were hurt because of how Ryan Day ran the offense this season? I'm going to jump in first and foremost and say that the person whose Heisman chances were hurt the most by way, and not just Ryan Day with the pace, but I think some of the red zone play calling and the way that Brian Hartline coordinated this offense, which is counterintuitive to what we would have expected. The person whose Heisman Trophy candidacy was destroyed the most was Jeremiah Smith's.
I mean, it's hard to say that the way the offense was run has taken away the chance of Julian winning the Heisman when he is a finalist. You know, I mean, he is going to New York. He will be there on Saturday night and be represented and be the fifth Ohio State quarterback in the last 8 years to be a finalist for the Heisman. Do I think Ohio State could have pushed tempo more and had numbers that were crazy for Julian this year and done a lot more? Sure. But as you said, it's part of the offensive game plan. Part of it was losing Jeremiah and Carnell for a couple weeks. Part of it is just understanding that that's not what Ohio State wanted, and that's not what they really needed out of Julian this year. But I also think that his statistical output was good enough to get him there, because clearly he's there. And I want to run something by you here, Austin. Let me put up these stats.
You can, but I'll just say while you're putting them up, Julian Sayin would have won the Heisman if Ohio State won on Saturday. You will not convince me otherwise. And I can't prove if I'm right or wrong. That is what I firmly believe. The way that Ohio State played and approached their offense, most people are aware that being, and maybe this will happen Fernando Mendoza on Saturday night, winning that game was going to be ultimately all that mattered. If he was the quarterback of the 13-0 defending national champions, Julian Sayin would have won the Heisman.
I agree. So in this year, Julian Sayin's statistical output, 3,323 yards, 78% completion, 31 touchdowns, 6 interceptions. In 2006, when Troy Smith won the Heisman, he threw for 2,500 yards, 30 touchdowns, and six interceptions, and completed 65% of his passes. Now, Troy ran for 204 yards and had a touchdown there. But sometimes the year works out that the stats aren't really what people are looking for. This wasn't a year nationally. Fernando Mendoza's stats are not crazy. Diego Pavia's stats are not crazy. Jeremiah Love's stats are kind of crazy. If I had a Heisman vote, I'd probably give it to Jeremiah Love because I thought he was the best player on the field all year long. And by that, I mean, he was healthy, making impact in every game.
What about Miami?
What about Miami? I don't remember.
He ran for 33 yards, which is why Notre Dame's not in the college football playoff.
Well, I mean, that's a fair argument. But Heisman isn't generally given to running backs, so it doesn't matter. Did Julian do enough to win the Heisman this year? Statistically, 100%. If they won the game on Saturday, he wins the Heisman. I agree with you there.
So, and this comes back a lot. You know, we talked to Jerry Emig a ton over the years. We had him on the Notebook after his his horseshoe retirement game, and the stress and all the work that goes on behind the scenes. sometimes he has been blamed for players not getting enough national attention and national awards. You know, if you took six of CJ Donaldson's touchdowns and gave them to Jeremiah Smith, then he would have won the Heisman. And again, I can't prove it. That's a hypothetical. Like, there's no PR campaign that is going to trump that. And Ohio State did that for both Julian Sain and Jeremiah Smith this year. And if Jeremiah doesn't win the Biletnikoff trophy, which it seems like he's not likely to, and Julian doesn't win the Heisman, it won't be for any lack of PR effort. I think that Greg is on to something, that Ohio State, the way that it coaches games and it's what it's chasing, which is team goals, often puts some of the stuff, the statistical stuff that would win them individual acclaim, on the back burner. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But when you're, and I don't even think you need to find someone to blame for it. Communications. They just called the game wrong. They're playing at the wrong tempo. Like, Ohio State's goals should be to win a national championship over winning anything else. You said about a month ago that it would be a great thing for Ryan Day to add to his recruiting resume if he does that one more piece that he can add that doesn't already exist by winning a Heisman or coaching a Heisman Trophy winner. Like, you know, it's cool, but college football awards voting is super dumb, and I've said it for 15 years.
Facts. It's not really something that Ohio State is going to allow itself to worry much about. But if they are, then they're going to get an opportunity to repeat it next year, because Jeremiah and Julian will both be there with the offense leading it from there. So, you know, the fact is, this is a team that was worried about winning things as a team. Ryan Day said back in November back in October, when they launched the Heisman websites, like, if he felt that this was something that was being pursued or that the guys were being selfish about it, they wouldn't have even done it. So the point for Ohio State has always been to put the team first. And if those other opportunities, those other accolades come, then great. But if they don't, then that's fine too. So, right. And also, I have a confession, Austin.
Okay.
I finally stopped pretending I was fine, and I did what you did, and I started Awaken 180 on Monday.
Oh, good for you.
I've like watched you melt away in the last 3 years, and it's kind of sad. I've watched Brandon Beam shrink in real time, Scotty Vegas, other friends who've like aged in reverse. And meanwhile, I'm over here carrying the same like 40 extra COVID pounds that I've had. Like, it's a media credential, you know? And so I get it. Spending 6 hours in the car multiple times a week doesn't help, but like, that's just an excuse. The holidays, another excuse. And I'm dropping that one too. So I started this week, Awaken 180, cruising through the first week. I feel a lot better. Honestly, I'm getting a lot more energy. You can hear it in my voice. My joints feel good, which is a big deal for me because, as you know, I suffer from some arthritis. And as I'm getting up there in age, that little bit of decreased inflammation is pretty, pretty good. So there's like this new power, you know, waking up every day with Awaken 180. And that's given me that. So I've been watching you succeed. I've been watching other people succeed. And if other people out there don't want to watch me succeed, do it yourself. Because someday never comes unless you start today. So I've already weighed in this week. I can't wait to tell you what it's going to be on Monday when I weigh in for the week. But for everyone out there who's got some questions about how they can lose some weight, what they can do, check into awaken180weightloss.com and do what we've all done with 97.1 The Fan and what I'm excited to continue doing. So I just wanted to bring that out and put it out there for everyone in case they're wondering, if they're starting to worry that I'm fading away into nothing. It's because of that. And I feel pretty good about it. So let's...
I mean, you were also pretty stressed. So you know,
I have been pretty stressed.
It could have been that. So it's nice that you give people an explanation for that. Awaken 180 has worked for me, and I'm glad that you're giving that a shot as well. Rob, he doesn't care about any of that. He wants to know. Well, maybe he does. I shouldn't speak for you, Rob. I'm sorry. Maybe you do care about us, but he does more care about our thoughts about the limited coaching Rolodex that he's assuming Brian Hartline has. We did talk about this in the immediate aftermath of his move, but I'll read the rest of the question before finishing that thought. Is there anyone on staff that is likely to go with South Florida with him, and how careful does he need to be when it comes to possibly recruiting anyone from Ohio State to join him at South Florida, including the players? So I'll preface it before kicking it over to you, Berm, by the conversations that I have had in the Woody this week, which don't guarantee anything, but I'm just saying there is not an anticipation or an expectation that any of the full-time accountable positions on Ohio State staff, that those people would be lured away by South Florida. You know, again, anything can change. I can't speak for the individual motivations of all of them, but South Florida's salary pool is dwarfed by Ohio State. They even any position across the board. There's not a really a spot where they could pay more money. If they want more responsibility, certainly that could change the dynamic. But right now, Ohio State is not like living in any uncertainty that or fear that that's going to happen.
No, and the Buckeyes have a number of staff members who are in line for that sort of move. And none of them are going to make a move that's a lateral move to go to South Florida. So let's be clear about that. If there's an opportunity, and we talked about this last week on the mailbag, if there's comes an opportunity for someone like Billy Fessler to be an offensive coordinator or something like that in South Florida, I think it's something he'd consider, but it would still take quite a bit of financial incentive for him to do it because Ohio State pays him pretty well. And the same thing with Keenan Bailey. The second part of Rob's question, which is about how careful does he have to be recruiting these people, I think is pretty important because the fact is Ohio State is expecting Brian Hartline to treat this process with respect, not burn bridges, make sure that he's being respectful to Ryan Day and his staff and Ross Bjork and the administration in Columbus. And if Brian Hartline has any part of him that ever wants to return to Ohio State, and if that's one of the motivating factors for taking this job because he thinks maybe it will help put a springboard to taking over at Ohio State when Ryan leaves, I don't think that's a bridge you want to burn or a way that you want to go out. So support staff, certainly we expect that to happen. That's happened anytime an Ohio State coach has left to go somewhere else. That is fine and understandable. But when you're talking about the 10 full-time countable assistants or 9 full-time assistants, I just don't see that happening.
All right. Yeah. So I just wanted to double check here. I'm looking at the database from USA Today about salary pool that South Florida had in 2024. And I'm sure, or I would assume, that they were planning and promising to Brian Hartline that they would upgrade it. But between their two coordinators, Todd Orlando made $550,000 and Joel Gordon made $450,000. So they spent $1 million on their two coordinators combined. Billy Fessler, I don't have to look this one up, as the quarterback's coach, made $475,000. So, you know, that's what we're talking about. And he was the position coach for a Heisman Trophy finalist, and he has proven to be a real asset to Ryan Day. If he needs to ask for more money to remain in that position and doesn't want to just climb the ladder by dropping down a competitive level to become a coordinator at South Florida, I would promise that Ohio State could make that happen for them. So again, he was making more as a quarterback's coach than South Florida's offensive coordinator did a year ago. That's important to keep in mind. That's also been important about like every job that is mentioned for Ohio State coaches. The salary pool that started with Gene Smith and it has not slowed down with Ross Bjork, they're putting not just with the 10 countable coaches, but also with the support staff and analysts and quality control people. Ohio State is paying whatever it takes to keep talented people in the Woody Hayes Athletic Center. They are not going to have that brain drain going on that did happen for this program for a number of years. And so that's not a threat. I think the interesting part, go ahead.
I just want to chime in. Like, I'm not sure that it's always fully understood how different life is at Ohio State than it is in most places. So obviously, you know, as a Toledo resident and a quasi Rockets fan, they just hired a new head coach this week because Jason Candle took a job at the University of Connecticut. And Mike Jacobs' salary pool for his staff for 10 assistant coaches is $1.5 million.
Yeah. Okay. South Florida, I think, was like $2.5 million total for.
Yeah. I'm sure Brian Hartline is going to get double that out of them with the commitment they're making with a new stadium and all that stuff. But it's still a very tough pull for those group of four schools or lower to make that sort of impact anymore. It just doesn't, like the idea that coaches used to be like, hey, this is the natural progression. I'm a quarterbacks coach, then I'm an offense coordinator, then I'm a head coach. Like that just doesn't exist anymore. You're better off being a quarterbacks coach, co-OC at Ohio State than you are being a full-time assistant coach or offense coordinator somewhere else.
Yeah. And I want to add too with the player situation, and you are as involved and aware of this as anybody. You know, Brian Hartline will know like who the potential portal candidates are. And I want to phrase this the right way. Like the people that are not necessarily viewed as integral to the future of Ohio State's plan, you know, what their NIL situations are. Like I would frankly be surprised. He should be using that to his advantage, I think, to get a head start at South Florida. And Ohio State wouldn't mind that part at all. If they are the bottom third of the roster and Brian Hartline can go get a jump start at a lower level with players who've been in the Woody Hayes Athletic Center, I think he will be more than welcome to do so. But I don't think that at the top of the roster, there's any world where you could convince, because the first thing that we heard, or the first thing that we were both asked, Berm, well, are Jeremiah and Brandon Ennis going to go back? They're Florida guys. Could they go play there for Brian Hartline for that last year of college eligibility? These are two of the highest achieving, highest achieving wide receivers in the country. They're going to go drop down to the American Athletic Conference and not compete for national championships at Ohio State? I don't think so. So it's not a world where I think that Brian Hartline could tamper with the starting lineup at Ohio State and take them to Tampa. I don't think that's a realistic world.
Yeah, I don't either. I think that there's legitimate reasons or not maybe concerns, but at least speculation or thoughts in your head, like would Brian Hartline's departure mean that Jeremiah Smith would go to Miami or somewhere else? I think that's a more fair question to ask. I think the interesting thing that Brian Hartline's going to run into here, especially when it comes to the wide receivers, and I think that's probably mostly what Rob is asking about, although I think it makes some sense for them to talk to Lincoln Kienholz and see what he's thinking about as Hartline and his staff down there at USF try to retain Byron Brown, their very electric quarterback down there, who is going to not play in their bowl game, but he's going to coach in their bowl game. So he's going to obviously see what the Brian's plans are there. But one thing that's interesting about the receiver conversation, especially if you talk about like Bryson Rogers, Mylon Graham, guys like that, the reason they haven't played at Ohio State ostensibly is because of Brian Hartline. So I don't know that he's going to be, I'm interested in how that conversation would go if with those guys, because to say, hey, well, you're just not good enough to play at Ohio State yet, but you're good enough to play for me down here. I mean, maybe it's that easy. Maybe these guys really appreciate that sort of earnestness and forthrightness, but definitely Ohio State would rather lose their players, the bottom third of that roster, as you're talking about, to someone like Brian Hartline, who's going to A, be out of the conference, B, be guys that you can root for because you're never going to play them again, and C, it probably gives them a little bit of a leg up as they head into the transfer portal window to know what they may need from that sort of potential attrition.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. We had so many more questions. I even had one lined up here about NFL draft decisions and what we might be hearing as the players got a little bit of a week to talk about that and get some feedback from the coaching staff and at the NFL level and with agents and everything else. I'm going to put a pin in that one. We're going to come back to it next week. And I think, you know, we'll have another Freaky Friday mailbag next week. That's the right day. We're trying to wait on the exact schedule of availability before Ohio State prepares for the Cotton Bowl. I don't think that there's going to be any at all next week as they ramp back up into those practices. So that's probably the 22nd. So we will need your questions to the Austin and Berm Show at gmail.com. And that will even be an episode all of its own to look at what this roster transition period could look like for Ohio State. It might be a good time to do that before they get back out there to prepare for the Cotton Bowl in Texas A&M or Miami. So if it didn't get to your questions, we still appreciate it. Thanks for writing in. Thanks for watching. Thanks for following along on 97.1 The Fan and 10TV and 10TV Plus. And that's it, Berm. You're going to have a great weekend in Cincinnati, aren't you?
I'm going to sure try my best. That's all you can ask for.
What happened to the enthusiasm? You just said you were feeling better.
Well, the playoffs are out of the picture now for the Bengals, so there's not really any reason to be optimistic.
Okay. Well, Michigan fired its coach, and Ohio State's the number two seed in the playoffs, so hopefully that can get you through to next week. Thanks again for following along. We sincerely appreciate you and the Waterworks for making the Austin and Berm Show happen. Have a fantastic week. For Berm, I'm Austin. So long.